Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Everyone, welcome to the newest edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and it's Happy New Year's to all of you. We are actually recording this New Year's night, and I've got a great panel, and we're going to talk about one of those things that feels thematically good for the beginning of the year, and that's happiness. Lots of us have desire for 2012 to be our happy year, happier than we've been, and we know that a lot of the decisions that are on people's minds about where do I find happiness, is happiness within the church, is it without the church, what are the different questions and issues that deserve to be asked about happiness, and not just simply assume it the way that we have in the past. So that's our goal basically today, is to complexify the question of happiness, also maybe to simplify it when we get done with it, and I've got three great guests that will help us do that. I will go ahead and say one thing at the beginning. This topic became a possibility about a month ago when Greg Rockwell, who's one of our three panelists, wrote a post in one of the online discussion groups where he talked about a friend that he knew back on his mission had heard that Greg was now outside the church, and this person really wanted to have a strong reason. You know, he wanted to do it, and Greg was like, I don't really want to complexify this guy's life. What should I do? How do I gracefully not engage this person? And what happened from there was really one of, I think, the best Facebook threads that you can kind of imagine, which was a lot of people weighing in on, wow, is happiness really possible outside the church as it is in? So if all things were equal, would you want to stay in or stay out? And it was just a really great thing. And Jared Anderson, another one of our guests, said this would be a great Mormon Matters. And I took him up on that. And we've probably had how many hours of discussion that we've had so far online? Quite a bit.
Yep.
Anyway, well, let me just go ahead and introduce the guests. And Jared Anderson, seeing how you're our veteran here at Mormon Matters, would you reintroduce yourself to our audience?
Yeah. Excuse me, a little bit under the weather, so hopefully my voice hangs in there. I am really glad to be here on Mormon Matters. Dan was expressing in a phone call the other day that maybe I've been on too frequently, so that has to be a good thing, right?
It was only because we're going to do another one next week that you might be on. So anyway, I was teasing. But
okay, I really love religious discussion. It's not only my hobby, it's my career. I'm finishing up my PhD from UNC Chapel Hill in biblical studies, but I'm also extremely interested in the larger religious questions. And this is a key one, so I'm very, very glad that we're doing this. I applaud you, Dan, for going down this road, because I think it's tackling an extremely big and important question. So I have now been involved in Mormon Stories, Mormon Matters, and Mormon Expression. So I think that is an accomplishment I'm proud of, as someone who values breadth and bridging and approaching across the entire spectrum. So I think that's enough of an introduction.
Very cool. Thanks for coming back on. We love having you. And all that other stuff about too much was not like we don't enjoy you, I promise.
Right. That was lighthearted, of course.
Okay, good. Good. Greg Rockwell, I've mentioned you as the instigator of this, even though you didn't imagine it at the time. Would you introduce yourselves? And why don't you go ahead and give just a little bit enough of a biographical story about where you are within the Mormon spectrum and worldview right now, and then we'll certainly deal with that in greater detail later.
Sure. Yeah, I'm really happy to be on here. I don't have any sort of academic reason that I deserve to be talking about anything, just kind of a loud mouth and a willingness to engage. And I have been mostly involved at Mormon Expression. I'm working with Heather quite a bit on the new Mormon Expression Voices podcast, have been on a couple of Mormon Expression episodes, and then I'm happy to be contributing here. I also have a small personal blog that is just breaking my brain over all of these different things at thedoorswingsbothways.blogspot.com, and can be found pretty frequently on various of the Facebook discussion pages. I, am kind of probably quite typical of a lot of self-proclaimed apostates. I grew up in a very orthodox frame of mind, loved the church a lot, loved my mission a lot. I am one of the probably few people that is willing to say that I really loved the temple a lot, my experience there, didn't have weird ideas about it, and really framed my entire life in that way. I am in my mid-30s, have 4 children. Most of the things about my life are probably fairly sort of typical of the Mormon narrative, right? Got married very soon after my mission. And I think the easiest way to put it is that somewhere around 5 years ago, things started to kind of come apart for me in terms of my feelings about the church. I didn't really confront historical issues until everything had already hit the fan. And it just was working for me less and less, something that I had expected to work for me, forever. And that process of asking myself what was going on and trying to study both in the scriptures and in general conference talks, go to the temple, fast and pray, and then also, this is probably the real linchpin, I started to read a lot of sociology and psychology and books about behavioral economics, and started to think a lot about how people work and kind of in the context of where I was at. And to make a 5-year story short, earlier this year, I was really having anxiety, or earlier last year now, I was really having anxiety attacks pretty frequently at church, and had really lost my conviction completely that it could at all be true in a literal sense. And that was giving me massive problems that I was just in a total turmoil, and finally stopped going to church, sort of found myself online for the first time looking at Mormon things, and found the different groups, found New Order Mormon, which was a godsend, found Mormon Stories and Mormon Expression, and all of a ton of friends, and have made, and have gone through just a whirlwind of a year in 2011, sort of refiguring out our lives and reconstructing those things. And so that's kind of, I think, where we're at, where I'm at, and my family consequently with me now.
Cool. And we're going to offer all of our disclaimers here in a second, but Greg, you've at least like put out there in front of everybody, here's at least 11 reasons why I feel myself happier now than I was before. And so in some ways you're going to kind of represent for us on this call the person who says, I am happier now than I ever was in, or at least I'm happier now than I was within the last 5 years of my experience there, right?
Yeah, I mean, I want to problematize that somewhat, because I have said to other people, I was very happy at various points in my Mormon life in the church. I was a very happy 8-year-old in the church, and I was a very happy missionary in the church. I was a very happy deacon and teacher and priest. I wasn't a very happy scout ever. I wasn't a happy BYU student. But I really have a desire, and my friends that I've talked with about this know, I really have a desire to not try to rewrite my life story to try and make it more sinister than it was. Because it really wasn't all that sinister. It just became less and less satisfying, or less and less, it just wasn't working. And I think that's an important thing. A lot of people talk about, they become their new God. They want their new God to be rationality as opposed to faith. And I think we pretend like those are, or we talk about those as being these big reasons, that we can write down. But when the real root, I think, of losing your faith usually begins with having emotional problems, you know, having it not work for you at some level for some reason, and that disconnect and that disconcertment growing. And I know that that's, you know, I know that that's my own experience, and so.
Okay, good. Well, I guess I said that because Casey, I know you're going to have some disclaimers too, but Casey Kern is our third guest. Let me introduce yourself there. And Casey, I don't want to put you in the position of like, I'm going to argue that only happiness is within the church, but on the other hand, you are somebody who is having still good experiences within Mormonism and has thought about these in broad ways.
Sure. Yeah, so I'm Casey Kern. I run the website BookOfMormonOnline.net, which is kind of an interactive scripture study resource. I grew up in the church. I still am in the church. And I spent my early years in Europe, actually, and I was, had some experiences kind of as a child being a religious minority, being, you know, the only LDS kid in school. Then moved to Utah, where all of a sudden was in the majority. So I like to think that I've kind of experienced Mormonism in various contexts and can speak to a variety of angles. Also, just in terms of a family, I've got pioneer stock in my ancestry, and also other ancestors who joined the church in Europe, and also in my extended family. Is Richard Bushman and Ed Kimball are both great uncles of mine, and I grew up on the same street as Grant Palmer, so I kind of found myself just kind of around interesting Mormon things and Mormon discussions. So you know that's kind of the water I've been swimming in. Scripture study has been an important part of my life and my religious experience, you know, which is one of my motivations behind the running the Book of Mormon site. I currently live, I graduated from BYU. I currently live in the Bay Area, and I serve in my ward as ward mission leader. And as such, I deal with both recent converts, but some people may not realize that ward mission leaders are also involved with kind of the, they call it the rescue effort, kind of dealing with people who are less active or, you know, who are struggling with their relationship with the church. So in that sense, I somehow, you know, feel that I'm kind of in the cross traffic of both lanes, in the revolving door of Mormonism, and, have a number of perspectives and experiences that have come through that. So that's
very cool.
That's who I am. That's what I bring to the table.
Well, we're excited to have you, and all of you guys are going to bring a ton. I can already tell from our pre-conversation. As just for our listeners, to let you know what we decided would be good to do. It kind of started organically, where everyone's like, "There's this aspect, this aspect." We're going to go theoretical at first. We're going to take some of our favorite insights from various sources, everything from, you know, different talks that have given at TED, which a lot of people will know what that is, and we can explain a little bit more if we go there, to just books that we've read, perhaps other religions and their takes on it. We're going to also talk about Latter-day Saint scriptures and Latter-day Saint rhetoric about what is happiness. And so we're just going to kind of go theoretical on happiness to begin with. And then we're going to get a little bit more into personal journeys, personal takes that we're hoping will be sort of, I don't know, just a discussion that sits there in front of you as listeners, that sort of lays out as best we can different things that might be worth considering as anybody makes their way through this question of happiness inside the church, outside the church. Shall I stay? Shall I go? What can I expect? What are the factors that might be at play in my brain other than pure rationality and all that different stuff? So that's kind of what we're going to do. So theoretical, guys, I just ask every one of you to pick a few of your favorite insights about happiness in general. And Jared, why don't you start with one of yours? We'll go Greg, we'll go KC, and we'll just, why doesn't everybody just kind of take two or three rounds of throwing out what they find to be fascinating about the question to begin with? So, Jared, you ready with one of them?
Yeah, that sounds good. Should we keep the listeners guessing as to what my position is, or should I declare that as well?
Why don't you declare? Yeah, that'll be good.
Okay, because
we got those guys in there. Yeah, let's do that.
I want to speak very, very carefully, but I am going to make the argument that you can have a lot of the happiness advantages that come from being outside the church while being in the church. One way that I've been thinking about this, and I'm very aware of the complexity and we'll tease that out, is I really like thinking about living a version of Mormonism as I feel it should be, not necessarily immediately being obligated to follow every nuance of the culture and institutional approach automatically, but to say, how can I live Mormonism my way, for lack of a better way to put it? So we'll tease that out as the time goes on. So happiness. So you want us to just say a few things and keep going around, or lay out?
Well, yeah, I mean, every one of you guys posted either a clip or, you know, a TED Talk or a Krista Tippett program or something like that that said, hey, everybody listen to this. And I took the time and listened to them all and thought there were interesting points there. So I would love everybody just to pick one of their favorite moments or at least insights into happiness that maybe puts an interesting angle or a spin on it.
Yeah. I'm going to start with expectations. I think that happiness has a tremendous, tremendous amount to do with our expectations. On one side, how much our reality matches our expectations, and then how we adjust our expectations to reality and thus regain an equilibrium. Of course, Buddhism, that's a very large part of it, you know, is that suffering comes from desire, from craving things to be a certain way. And so if you don't crave things to be a certain way, you'll have greater equilibrium.
Right.
So that's one.
Okay, good. So expectations is going to be something that, as we really get into the meat of it later, we're going to keep that in mind. Do either of you guys want to complexify or add a little more to Jared's, or do you just want to go right into your next one?
Well, probably because I obsess about this concept a little bit, and I'll try not to get too geeked out about it here. I'd like to sort of add to that conversation about expectations, that there's solid research on it, and the best one, a very good book to read about that now is a book called The Paradox of Choice by Barry Schwartz, who's a psychologist, and wrote that the best way to be, and his sort of bottom line is that the best way to be happy is to lower your expectations, because you are happy, or you get utility, I guess, happiness utility, happiness currency, when you exceed your expectations. But when you meet or fall below your expectations, then you're disappointed. The problem with that, he points out, is that modern life has taught us to expect a lot. And he uses all kinds of examples, like having, you know, 150 different pairs of jeans to choose from to try and find the right one. You're going to feel overwhelmed with the sort of importance and of a non-important choice. And right. And you're going to set up all sorts of expectations that it's going to be really hard to fulfill. I think we feel this. I think we instinctively feel that when we think about, like, living as pioneers. You know, we all, especially in the Mormon narrative, we all think about what would it have been like to cross the plains, and what would life have been like. And we, I think, create a narrative that says, I would have had lower expectations. I would have had lower expectations for my health, for my wealth, for the engaging, interesting things I would do, for the level of sophistication that I would have been able to sort of engage the world with, for my entertainment choices, for my food choices, you know, and so we think life was simpler then. And it's this paradox of kind of thinking of the good old days and how much better they were, even while then you can come up with all sorts of reasons why the good old days were, you know, awful. Your wife would have died in childbirth and stuff.
Exactly.
And so I think that has been something really compelling to me. Another area of research, or another couple of researchers in behavioral economics that have really looked at this tremendously, two of the maybe top researchers thinking about happiness in that area are Daniel Gilbert and Daniel Kahneman. Daniel Kahneman is the father of behavioral economics. And he says, we mess up the idea of happiness. I think we do this in the church a lot. We mess up the idea of happiness because we use one word to describe lots of different things. And he says, really fundamentally, you kind of have at least two things that we conflate in happiness. And one is our happiness with our life position, and the other is our experiential happiness. So one is kind of the happiness we have with our memories and how our life is put together. And then also, you know, are we actually happy moment to moment? Daniel Gilbert wrote a book that I think you read, Dan, called Stumbling on Happiness. I read it a long time ago. Right. It was one of my first entries into kind of this world. And he focuses a lot on happiness in the moment, and he uses it in large part to discredit the idea of the worth of having children. I might be twisting him a little bit, but that's definitely one of the things I was thinking about a lot when I was reading it, was that people think that they're going to be happy because they have, you know, when they have children, then when they have children, they're miserable. And then after the children are gone, they recreate their memories to think that they were really happy. Daniel Kahneman says, you know, those are two different things. One is the moment when you're in it, and the one is how you sort of contemplate your life. And I think that's the most useful way for us to approach happiness as we're trying to figure out what it means in the church. I used to teach in Sunday school and in seminary that happiness is not cheerfulness. Like when the Lord is talking about happiness, he's not talking about being cheerful, because that was the only way I could make sense of it. And I think that that still is applicable. And as we get closer into the church conversation, you know, we can look at that. But the main thing is, as you understand that happiness means different things, and that yourself is kind of divided there, the side that you're attending to, whether you're trying to attend to your experience or whether you're trying to attend to your sort of the structure of your life and the memories that you're going to be creating and the value of those memories, that will drive different behavior. And it'll drive maybe significantly different behavior.
Right. The larger point here is that, yeah, there's the experiential happiness in the moment, and then there's the happiness that we reflect on it. One of the ones from the talk that you, I think, linked us to from Kahneman was the person who listens to this wonderful transcendent music for 20 minutes, you know, this great symphony and stuff like that, but then there was some sort of screech or thing at the end, and he then says, the whole thing was ruined by that. You know, it's sort of that idea of, here you are, is your experience, and here's now the memory and the shape that he's added onto that experience. So I think that's a very important point.
Yeah, that was fascinating. The idea is that the only thing you get to take away from your experiences is your memory. You don't get to keep the experience. You only get to keep the memory, and your brain creates memories in a specific way.
Exactly. Yeah. That was fascinating. Yeah. And what was it? Everything beyond that happened beyond 3 months ago doesn't count.
Yeah.
You know, because it's all at that point, it's all your framing of it. So, Casey, do you want to either comment on either Jared or Greg's, or you want to add one of your own that you found to be an interesting theoretical position on happiness?
So one thing I threw out in addition to that, we've got both the happiness in the present and kind of memories of happiness in the past. A big component of it, I think, is also happiness in the future. That I think that happiness can be seen kind of as a universal end game that pretty much everyone is after in one manner or another. People may have different goals or dreams or aspirations, but I think if you were to ask the follow-up questions of, you know, why do you want to do this? Why do you want to do that? You know, why do you want to be successful? Why do you want to be rich? Why do you want a family? You know, and you ask these questions, and you keep on asking why. I think it will come down to I want to be happy. I had a manager who would always tell the story that when he was a kid, teachers would ask him, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And, you know, all the other students would say fireman or policeman or whatever. And his answer was always, I want to be happy when I grow up, which, you know, may be something for a Hallmark card. But I think I think there's something of substance there. You know, why do the other kids want to be firemen or policemen? Well, you know, it's exciting. Well, why do you want to do exciting things? You know, because I like doing exciting things. Why do you like it? Well, it makes me happy. I think happiness, especially in the future as it relates to goals and aspirations, it feels to me like a universal thread that kind of binds humanity. And I think we also see this kind of in a religious context also about happiness kind of awaiting us in the future, afterlife and heaven and all kinds of ways that we understand happy places that we might end up if we follow a certain life course. So I guess that's what I throw in for complicating happiness, is kind of that future element of it.
Can I follow up on that, Dan? Because my next point ties right into that.
Do it.
I think a different way of saying the same thing, I really like the past, present, future schema we have. I think it's interesting that happiness is subjective completely. And an interesting philosophical question is misguided happiness real happiness? You know, if we have a mistaken understanding of reality that makes us happy, kind of a similar, you know, is ignorance bliss, is a related topic. But I think that a sense of meaning, accomplishment, and purpose is extremely important to happiness. And one of the advantages of a religious worldview is that very often we are framed as being the center of the universe. That's part of the religious mythic framework, is that we are cosmically important, and that does give a real sense of purpose. And religion in general has this narrative of very powerful meaning, and that we can tie into that. But I think that we do need a sense of that life is meaningful, what we're doing is meaningful. And I think that ties into the goal discussion that Casey was having.
Good. And Greg, you seem to come back on that one a little bit in our pre-conversation. Do you want to go right and challenge the overarching purpose, those kinds of things right now? Or do you want to just stay out of that for now and we'll go after that later?
You know, I don't mind talking about that a little bit now. I see, and I know that secularists struggle with the meaning of life, that there's that, you know, what does it all mean? I think especially in the church, you have this idea that on leaving or on losing faith, the world becomes nihilistic. And to a certain degree for myself personally, I would validate that a little bit. But I can't validate it very much. And I wonder if our sense of importance comes from our religious sensibilities, or if our religious sensibilities come from our sense of importance. I think there's a question of what came first, to Jared's point there. And that it's even, you know, our good friend Christopher Hitchens, who is either receiving the missionary discussions right now or is blissfully unaware. he was certainly felt like his life had purpose, and felt like there was a validity to his life, and felt like there was a large thing for him to accomplish. And he had a sense of, I think, grandeur in his approach to his life that has no theological underpinnings at all. So
I want to make a quick comment about that, Greg. I see what you're saying, that that human beings by nature are narcissistic to a degree. And so that will buoy them up. You know, we are the center of our own universes no matter what. We don't have access to anything else. Your Hitchens example, though, he represents someone in a position of a tremendous privilege and influence. And so he's an example where there is that immediate social affirmation. So he really does. He is the center of a large, you know, if you have an audience. But a lot of people don't have access to that. I read a Psychology Today article that talked about how, yes, I'm going to put it really bluntly. Yes, religion makes you happier, but only if your life sucks.
And I would agree with that. I'm totally okay with that concept, and believe that religion is, you know, that atheism is a privilege of the rich. And I'm totally okay with saying that. As I drive around and look at people, I look at, you know, thousands and thousands, millions of people that pass by me in my life that I never get to meet. And I frequently reflect on the fact that their life is just as complex and filled with drama and all the sort of things that are in my life, and I'm just not aware of those things. And that even, I would say, to counter rebut your Hitchens point, because I really like that example, but to counter rebut it, it doesn't really matter how large your audience is. You are still the protagonist of your own movie. You are still the center of it. in your small space, and you are surrounded in your small space by all the things that are working in your life that are that, and it all becomes relative from there, whether you're in some tiny little village in the Amazon or whether you are standing before thousands of people. It's very relative, and how much the difference between that level of affirmation or acceptance, acknowledgement is, you would get used to it no matter where you're at. You would get used to it if you have a small audience. You'd get used to it if you have a large audience. And I don't think that it would have very much impact. And I think there's, among some of the things that we've been quoting from the TED Talks and the books that we've been quoting from, it would say that those kinds of factors wouldn't have much of an influence on your happiness, even though we mistakenly think that they would. Or wouldn't have much of an impact on your sense of life's purpose, even though, again, we mistakenly assign more importance to that than really is warranted.
Yeah, I get the idea. I really like one of the valuable points with the TED Talks we were looking at pre-conversation is the fallacy that we think boundless freedom equals boundless happiness, and it doesn't. It really doesn't. And, you know, intriguingly talked about the benefits of not having alternatives. But at the same time, I do think that although he was talking about synthesized happiness, he didn't talk much about natural happiness in that one. And I do think that there does need to be a balance between empowerment and opportunity and freedom and also acceptance, based on our differing situation. And I'll bring this in later when we talk about our personal stories and happiness. But I was in a 7-year marriage that I was locked into. Like I would not consider any other alternative. So, you know, there was not that freedom open, and I was utterly miserable. We'll go into that more. So it's not just that we automatically adjust our happiness. At the same time, my younger brother is a quadriplegic. And so I really related to that idea of his acceptance, you know, and I took care of him for 2 summers. One other point I think is important about happiness is the resources that we have to deal with the opposite of happiness. And that's where we have the brain chemistry, you know, that we have our own tools up in our head to adjust to reality. We adjust to our realities very well in general. So we have mental, emotional immune system is what he called it, I think. So what resources we have to deal with sorrow, suffering, loss, disappointment. And I think supportive and loving relationships are an extremely important part of that happiness. And this is where something does not necessarily need to be true in order to make us happy. So especially the idea of an afterlife. I'm going to critique that later, Casey. But I do think one way that an afterlife works well, it cuts both ways. But I think that it can be beneficial in dealing with grief and loss. This idea that there's an afterlife, that we'll see people again. And I don't think there's any damage done to the 80-year-old woman who just lost her husband, thinking that he'll exist again, you know, or that she'll see him again.
Cool. Jared, you were talking to us about purpose, and Greg, you immediately went to theology and cosmic purpose. So I just wanted to make sure that we saw that happened. So I'm just wanting to frame it. Everyone kind of agrees that a purpose is helpful. A sense that your life has meaning, whatever the scale of that is. Whereas Greg, you were then immediately sending us, though, to cosmic importance, meaning child of God, eternally existing part of the universe, etc. So is that a fair summary of what happened?
Yeah, I guess I didn't mean to. I agree that a sense of purpose is really important.
But you don't think you need the mythic
stuff. I have a really hard time. I probably had a really hard time grappling with that as I was becoming a mature adult, very, very much invested in my Mormon faith, and started to distance myself from that before I realized I was distancing myself from faith. I have a hard time conceptualizing that personally. And I know, and it's one of those sort of things that makes me feel a little odd sometimes, is that I just can't get with the grandeur of some of these things. I would tell Sunday school class, for instance, I would say, if the church isn't making you happy now, if you're not happy, this afterlife stuff, you know, is not worth it. It needs to be working now. I was teaching that for years. and
even before you
take,
even before you
take my own medicine. Okay.
All right. So all along, you felt like present happiness, experiential happiness, was far more important than future happiness.
I just thought that this is what the scriptures say. It should be working. If it's not working for you, then there's a problem. Like that the yoke needs to be easy and the burden light. You know, I mean, that you need to be getting answers to your prayers. You need to be having the Spirit. You need to be having all of these things in this life. Otherwise, you need to be re-examining what you're doing. And at the time, I wasn't saying so, or you need to leave the church. I was saying, you know, or you need to figure out what's wrong with you. I want to say that I have changed my position on saying you need to figure out what's wrong with you, because that's fundamentally I sort of where I dug in and said, oh, wait, what if there is nothing wrong with you? What if it's just a broken system? What if it just doesn't work as advertised? But I love mythology and art and symbolism. I love meaning in things. I am a sucker for art. I mean, I love it so much I can't even say, and I grew up with it, and I'm highly invested in the ways that human beings express meaning and express their humanity. I have a really hard time taking it up to a cosmic level, and especially assigning any importance to sort of the cosmological realities of that when that's my apostasy, you know, really poking through there. I used to think, it'll be great when I have my own planet and everything. You know, I get to have eternal sex all the time. I thought that was a worthy goal to aspire to.
Cool. All right. Well, good. I think it's Casey's turn. Did you have any other additional angles on happiness at the theoretical level? I know somewhere along the line here, we're going to have you kind of bring it right into the Mormon wheelhouse. But before that, did you have anything else that you wanted to throw out there?
Sure. Yeah. Before I get into that stuff, I guess I would throw out that I think it's very important to acknowledge the relationship between happiness and our relationships with other people. I think a case could be made that you can't be happy in a vacuum. I mean, we talked about happiness being connected to a sense of audience, or, you know, if we're going to talk about, Jared, you mentioned your marriage. I think this connection between happiness and our interpersonal relationships of whatever kind kind of has to be in the mix as we go forward in terms of understanding happiness, and as it relates to, you know, kind of extrapolating it out to the cosmic level that we were just talking about. I think if we understand our happiness with, you know, among our friends, among our community, among our family, and we really, you know, experience the happiness or the joy that we might have in those communities or in those settings, and then use that as a microcosm for maybe understanding what it may be like on a more cosmic level. You know, that may be a useful maybe tool set for approaching that idea of you know, what is, you know, cosmic purpose and you know, our place as a child of God. What does that mean? You know, I think if we understand kind of our here and now and the relationships that we enjoy and the type of happiness that we enjoy through our relationships, I think all of a sudden, you know, understanding things on a kind of grander scale may be a little more easy to do.
Can I jump in real quick, because I love what you just said, Casey, and that has been one of the real epiphanies, was saying, wow, the only thing that's really making people happy, and this is both demonstrable with research and also in my real life, is my relationships with people. A little while ago, I want to push this back to Dan, because the greatest thing that I've ever heard you say, Dan, and that's probably indicative of me not listening to you very much.
Of course, they're all gems.
But you said in a podcast not too long ago, you said real relationships exist for themselves. I'm slaughtering it probably a little bit, but real relationships don't have an objective. They exist for themselves. And you weren't talking about it in the context, I don't think, of like relationship with God, But I'm trying to figure out my relationship with God, whether I have a relationship with God, whether I care, whether, you know, what that all means. And I immediately just gelled onto that and thought, wow, that is so true. The relationships that I have that I am happy about and that fill my life with joy, with my friends, with my wife, are relationships that are just valuable for themselves. There is no objective. But I look at my – and we can talk about this later as we sort of get back to the Mormon side of it, but and I'd like to. As I look at the way my Mormon relationship with God was framed, it's completely objective-driven, and it's really only objective-driven. There, that he has a plan for me. He has a place where he wants me to be. He has an objective for me that, you know, depending on how you view things, he's either doing well or he's a, you know, a lousy manager and is failing miserably at his job. But that thing about relationships and realizing that relationships are important, and then maybe realizing what does that mean about my relationship with God and how does that reflect on theology, that I think is worth looking at in terms of sort of projecting happiness forward as well.
Cool. And seeing how you used me in this relationship business, let me jump in for a second here. And I don't want to sound like I'm really contradicting you. I agree with what you said, that the church seems to lay it out there as if, you know, here's the plan, this is what I want for you, etc. Whereas at least in a lot of the podcasts that I've been trying to put on, I know we got into it in the prayer one recently, was this idea that, you know, there is this parent-child relationship and there is this stewardship relationship. And these are the two lowest levels of relationship with God. But yet we tried to at least lay out in our discussion there that there is these larger things of becoming a friend of God and eventually becoming the beloved of God. Well, first of all, there's the disciple of God, somebody who enters in the path, the discipline that would end up leading you to become the master rather than just the steward. So that's the discipleship phase. Then there's the friend stage, and then there's the beloved stage, where you totally delight in each other and you surprise each other. So in some ways, Greg, what you're saying there, I agree, happens at the Mormon discourse rhetoric level, but I don't think it happens fully at the gospel level. At the gospel level, I think where Casey's pointing us there, you look at the microcosm of a real relationship. I think Mormonism's great when it projects it into the eternities.
Yeah, I want to make a brief point that I was thinking of when Casey brought that up, where I think Mormonism potentially could work very well, is when you project present sociality into the eternities, which Mormonism does
more than anybody. Yeah,
yeah, it does with an enthusiastic literalness. You can also it also functions to divinize present sociality, and I think that that's potentially very productive. This idea that the family unit, the social unit, the way that we engage with each other, that is part of the eternal order. And in fact, one of my favorite points about Mormonism is, it's from the temple, but I don't think it's anything that we can't share, is that this world is the telestial kingdom, that like right now we are in eternity. And even apart from that one little temple tidbit, you know, we're between the pre-existence. There's this idea that this life is very, very much part of this divine heavenly type experience, and I think that could be beneficial. Could I make one more point about happiness?
Yes,
that's my
please.
My final point. I think that key to us being happy is being affirmed, like that our existence, that we are, that we in ourselves and from in our relationships, we are given the message that we are of value. We like being right on every level. You know, we have this deep, deep need to be right. And I think that's part of being happy. We're happy when we're right. And we can complicate that and parse that out a bit later. I also think it's interesting, and I imagine Greg will want to respond to this, that we are wired in a certain way for happiness. And one very interesting thing that caught my ear on NPR was that there is no depression in hunter-gatherer societies, while affluence and modern society is linked to increasing depression.
And suicide.
So that's, we need to take into account our physiology, our wiring, and I think that is an extremely important part of happiness.
I really, in talking about how we're kind of put together and looking at our evolutionary origins, I really like the idea of thinking through where we're supposed to be, like where our body tells us we're supposed to be and where our brain, what our brain is wired to do. For instance, one of the things that I find myself talking about with probably you and with my wife and various people a lot is, are these small groups that, you know, that we're really wired to be. Our morality is built around small groups. Our brain is built around having intimate connections with, say, 150-ish people that validates itself through all kinds of models that we see organizationally. The, you know, the church model of the ward is built around sort of that natural model that fits with the way our brain is built. That we also look at, like, say, large organizations, and that we see organizations become corrupt as they become too large to function in their, as humans are meant to say, to function. Or we look online and anonymity, we become immoral as we get to engage in anonymously and in large groups. And we, you know, we lose all of that concern that is really built into us to be in small groups. It's also, I'd say, it's a real easy thing to point at the failure of communism. Communism is built on this idea of, we're getting really off topic, but I just find all this fascinating. Communism is built on the idea of, like, you're supposed to take care of your brother, right? Well, as long as you're taking care of your brother in a smallish clan of like 150 people, then it's going to work really well. But when you go up to the size of the USSR, it's just a complete disaster, you know, and that's, it speaks to how we function best and how we find purpose and meaning in life, and where we sort of excel at being human. And that to me just is continually fascinating.
Very cool.
And I think that'll be a good thing to pick up on with how Mormonism works well or doesn't, because potentially I think this is one of the strengths of Mormonism. I do want to put out there, I think it's interesting, the other aspect of it, I alluded to it, but just to expand a little bit, is that modern life is not very conducive to this type of physiological wired happiness, that we are supposed to be active. We're supposed to be outside. We're supposed to be
eating real food.
Right.
That I'm a real foodie. I know Greg is too. I've had many an amazing meal at his house. And this is actually a massively important issue that does not pertain directly, but perhaps maybe for another episode or something, Dan, is, you know, you literally are what you eat. In German, that's brilliant because it's the same verb, something like man ist, was ist. But I think chemistry, like how we are altering ourselves chemically with processed foods, is extremely important. Have you done a Word of Wisdom episode? Maybe that'd be good.
Yeah, that would be good. Yeah, but no, I agree, and we'll link to this article that we were talking about here, because I thought it was the
Andrew Weil.
Andrew Weil, yeah, or however you say his name, yeah, Weil. But yeah, it was even to things like we're supposed to be in the sun X amount of time. We're supposed to have dark, you know, the whole circadian rhythms and everything that do that that just get thrown off, and so we are not in touch with what our biology has set us up for.
Yeah, and actually in sort of that mythic list of things that I posted on that conversation, several of these things that we're talking about really play into that. And so, you know, if we're moving in that direction, then I guess we'll get to sort of touch on how my life experience hit those, or maybe we're not. Maybe that as an aside, I don't know. But most of the things that we're talking about there kind of, I think, relate into some of the things that I was thinking about then.
Okay. You're talking about the list of 11?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we'll definitely get to that in a minute. So, okay, guys, broad theoretical framing. Everybody pretty much done. You know that you'll be able to work in any minor points as we move on. Are we ready to kind of go a little bit more into the Mormon-specific stuff?
Yeah, sure.
Sure.
Cool. Casey, we've asked you, or you volunteered somehow or other, but it's in our plan next for have you presenting, at least at first, sort of in a dispassionate way, some of the Mormon scripture, main sort of themes that we see in Mormon discourse on what happiness is, and then feel free to do as much or as little right now of your own personal journey here. We'll get to your, you know, personal takes a little bit later too, but go ahead and kind of present, and then, you know, at least hint at, as to what's to come when it comes to your personal takes.
Okay, sure. Well, I think any discussion of happiness or joy kind of in a doctrinal context within Mormonism typically starts with the scripture mastery, 2 Nephi 2:25, Adam fell that men might be, and men are that they might have joy. So I think right off the bat, core to Mormon theology is that the purpose of our existence is having joy. There's also a Joseph Smith quote that in which he says, "Happiness is the object and design of our existence." And even in kind of modern Mormon vernacular, the term "plan of happiness" has kind of increased in frequency, as opposed to "plan of salvation." And a plan of happiness, that term actually is found in the Book of Mormon in Alma 42. So that certainly isn't, you know, coming out of nowhere, but there certainly is that that increase in emphasis. So that's kind of the, you know, big picture kind of purpose of life equals happiness, and plan of happiness is, you know, again relates to why we're here on Earth, and that's, you know, that's kind of the standard teachings that we get in seminary and Sunday school.
Well, now let me add one last thing, because you talked about men are that might have joy. There's also that kind of fun thing from the temple, as well as I think it's in section 93 of the DNC. Everything to have joy in the measure of their creation. Everything right. With its own sphere. That's in other words, God's work and glory is for joy of all existing things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which Mormonism has this interesting little theology of, guess what? Everything that exists experiences, you know, in some way, whatever this intelligent stuff is. But right. Anyway, I just like it that it's not just super anthropocentric. It kind of goes deeper than that too. But that's a minor point. Get going again.
I think that's an interesting point, Dan. And I want to hover there at the temple for a second, because the specific quote you're talking about is that they may fill the measure of their creation, and it's talking about them multiply. It's the specific reference that God, you know, the activity God is talking about participating in is reproduction. And so as God is creating all these animals, he says, you know, that they'll make more of themselves after their own kind, that they may fill the measure of their creation and have joy therein. The only other place that I'm aware of, and I'm quite confident on this, although it's been a few years now, is that joy is really referenced, is hammering in the point that you should have children. So the temple sets people up to think that the source of their happiness in life, the primary source, the real source, the only one that's enumerated, is in having kids. And that has been something I've thought about over the years a lot.
Yeah, we don't need to hash this out right now, but I love all the rhetoric of joy that Casey was talking about, but I think that it has a rather dark underside in LDS tradition and culture, which is that there's this idea that we are supposed to be happy, our purpose is happy, and therefore if you are not happy, there's something wrong with you. And it doesn't really give practical ways. There are a lot of benefits, and we'll get into that. There are practices that happen in LDS culture. We take care of each other very well in general. But there's also this idea that if you're not happy, it's your fault. And then if there's a problem in your marriage, that going to the temple is a valid way to be happy again, rather than going to a marriage counselor. Again, we don't need to get into that right now, but I think...
Sure. And I do have some thoughts about that, about the place of unhappiness within this model. And we can get to that.
Okay, and let's let you go. So, Jared, you weren't echoing on Greg's point about the only thing that matters is multiply, replenish, fill the earth for joy. I sense that I could have a good discussion with you, Greg, that it isn't purely tied to that. So we'll just have to either play that out on the blog or you know, let me prepare for a minute. But I, at least in my dissertation, I put some good things out there that I think would tie it quite less to just pure multiply replenish, but
I'm sure it can be done. And Dan, I'm such a believer that Mormonism, and this is going to be a key point of my position, is that I will argue is Mormonism has the it's a Lego set where you can build something amazing and beautiful. But would you agree, Dan, that it is a message that many, many, perhaps most Mormons get?
Oh, that it has to be kids. Okay. Yes, I agree that many get it.
because those are two things, and both are valid. You know, what can be constructed with Mormonism and what kind of is. So
one thing I would like to throw in as it relates to happiness and the relationship with reproduction is as it relates to what we talked about before about relationships, you know, reproduction and, you know, fulfilling the measure of your creation. Not only is it creating children, but it both requires and produces more relationships, which then expands into communities and friendships and things like that. And I think we can draw a pretty direct line between, you know, the joy that comes from community building and friendships and family, and kind of how that that relates to the bigger picture of happiness.
Good, I like that. And that's where you're headed anyway. So why don't you go ahead and make your next sure. kind of points?
Yeah. So the next thing that we kind of get as it relates to happiness, especially in seminary and as we teach youth, wickedness never was happiness. That's, you know, that's kind of given with every stern warning of, you know, don't do such and such, don't do such and such, because there is no happiness in that direction. And there certainly is value in that. I think that that if we look carefully, we can maybe get some more meat out of that. So that comes from Alma 41, wickedness never was happiness. Samuel the Lamanite in the Book of Mormon says something similar, but he words it kind of in different ways that points it kind of a different direction. This is from Helaman 13. Samuel says, "Ye have sought all the days of your lives for that which ye could not obtain, and ye have sought for happiness in doing iniquity, which thing is contrary to the nature of that righteousness which is in our great and eternal head." I know that's a little bit to let that sink in for a bit. I think that the part that really interests me is when he says that happiness in, or, you know, seeking happiness in iniquity is contrary to the nature of the righteousness which is in our great and eternal head. He's almost appealing to some natural law that kind of supersedes anything else, almost in the vein of God would cease to be God if you know, right. Mercy would rob justice.
I was
justice.
Thinking of the same thing. I love the idea that, you know, in Mormonism, God is God because of what they've done. You know, that they have followed the rules of happiness. Of course, the point with a big target painted on it is the definition of iniquity and the definition of wickedness. And unfortunately, too often it's you need to live exactly as the church tells you to live. That equals righteousness. And anything the church tells you not to do is wickedness. And whereas I think we could frame it quite beautifully, if circularly, by saying iniquity are those things that by the nature of reality and relationships will not bring you happiness.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's definitely something there.
Yeah, I actually, and, you know, as the sort of, again, avowed apostate, if you frame it as things that actually exist and say, hey, when you do things that are damaging to your body and that actually have actual consequences as opposed to made up consequences that we're going to teach you with fear and trembling, I think that's a great definition. Teaching people real consequences is fantastic. I think to underscore several times Jared's point, those kinds of scriptures get used to manipulate people's behavior to toe the theological line and to be obedient to ecclesiastical authority. And so it almost seems self-evident. It's like, yeah, it's a beautiful thought. Is there any point in really talking about it? Because if you talk about it, then what we're really saying is you need to do what I tell you to.
Boy, that's not my experience of Mormonism. I have never felt like somebody would say do it out of fear. I mean, I obviously I've heard it, but I've never seen it go unchallenged where somebody won't give the theory. You know, I was actually quoting in some blog conversation this morning, DNC 8878, which is, you know, be instructed more perfectly in theory, principle, doctrine, and law. So if you're talking about law, here's the law, do this in some abstract way. No, that law is based upon some, you know, discursive teaching, which we'll call a doctrine, which is based upon some principle, which is based in the larger theory of happiness and human flourishing and all that stuff. So I don't know that I really see it as a power play, or at least getting away. Everyone would recognize the power play as ugly, basic, manipulative. And so I don't know, Greg, I'm not with you on that.
Okay, well, let me deliver it to you in slightly different codified language. And the angel said unto Adam, Adam, why dost thou offer sacrifices unto the Lord? And Adam said, I know not, save the Lord commanded me. And the point of the scripture, which I used to have in calligraphy on the top of my piano, is do things because I tell you to, not because I've told you why. And maybe someday I'll tell you why. And in the scriptures it says, I will tell you why. But the caveat is, you're not really allowed to ask. I mean, to take it.
Well, I don't know, but Adam would have had experiences if, you know, okay, so let's step inside the story. Adam had had experiences with God where God did deliver it face to face with him. So in other words, if I felt like I was having a robust relationship with God, to where I learned to trust that this truly is God's voice, and I really felt compelled to do something and I didn't know why, I wouldn't quite read it as this manipulative do things just because I said do it. I would say I'm doing it because my faith is in a trust relationship with this being rather than in a child because you could smite me or smash me kind of relationship.
Yeah, I would totally say that that's the right way that it should be. My sort of larger assertion, and one of the things that really became anxiety inducing in me, that really caused me to have great trauma, was that relationship, that close relationship that the scriptures portray of unambiguous walking and talking with God for Adam, or even for all of the people in the scriptures that have mundane, daily, miraculous occurrences where God speaks to them unambiguously, where he answers their prayers, where he does all this great stuff, where miracles happen all over the place. And the scriptures, if you were to take the scriptures at face value and say, these are demonstrating to me, or these are trying to teach me what it's like to have a relationship with God and the way God deals with his children, that is patently not the way that anyone's, that I know, that their relationship with God is. In fact, I would pretty strongly say that anyone who exhibits the kind of relationship with God that the scriptures talk about is going to get locked up as a loony. Like you would be considered delusional. You would be called a visionary man, and you would be called crazy. Nobody has daily miracles. Nobody gets answers to their prayers in the unambiguous way that the scriptures say it, that I've ever been able to find. That I've never been able to find somebody who basically says, "Oh yeah, the Lord came to me and, you know, showed me a vision."
But Greg, that's pushing it a little bit to the extreme.
It's my literal brain.
I'm a pretty mystical person, but also rational person. You know, I want things always, all the time. We'll get into that later. But I experienced a very literal, immediate, immersive type of spiritual experience within Mormonism, where I thought that the people in the scriptures were my buddies, and I remembered the preexistence, and I heard the voice of God. It was a very, very tangible, immediate, day-to-day thing. And I think a lot of people live like that.
Do you think people live like that, or they have moments like that? Because I will say, I've had moments of great spiritual experiences. I have no hesitation saying that spiritual experiences are an unusual and notable thing in our lives. But spiritual experiences in the scripture are mundane, quotidian, typical. And I would say that those twain do not meet. And if you once felt that way, Jared, I would say, do you feel so now?
Are you paraphrasing Alma at me?
Yes.
Boy, I have a lot to say to you, Greg. I would never consider scripture as supposedly reporting day-to-day stuff. It's certainly distilled. It's certainly, you know, selected for its impact. You know, so yeah, there's a lot of things that you're saying there that don't quite track for me. So I want Casey to get a little more, there's a few more Mormon things to throw out there.
Okay, another point that comes through in the Book of Mormon as it relates to happiness that I'd like to point out is the vision of the Tree of Life. Lehi says that says, "I beheld a tree whose fruit was desirable to make one happy." And when we get the interpretation of the dream, we learn that the fruit is the love of God. And I think, as we talked about, you know, happiness kind of being a fruit of relationships previously, if we understand, I guess, the fruit from the vision as being the love of God, we can see a clear connection as to how love in our interpersonal relationships is the means, as Lehi says, to make one happy. And I think that that's kind of an overarching kind of universal theme of happiness is found in the love of God and the love of God that we share amongst ourselves as children of God. And I think one example that comes through dramatically again from the Book of Mormon is the story of Ammon, who are actually all the sons of Mosiah, go teach and live among the Lamanites. And at the conclusion of their 14 years out there, where they, you know, consecrated themselves and devoted themselves, it says, this is from Alma 27, "Now the joy of Ammon was so great, even that he was full. Yea, he was swallowed up in the joy of his God, even to the exhausting of his strength." And it talks about him falling to the earth, and Mormon asks, "Now is this not great exceeding joy?" And he says that, you know, the other sons of Mosiah were also joyful, but not quite to the point of, what does it say, exceeding their strength. But I mean, in terms of where does the rubber meet the road, in terms of the theory of, you know, this divine love that's supposed to make us happy, I think the teachings point towards the fact that as we serve others, as we live among people, as we learn and grow together, that's when we kind of experience the type of transcendent joy that I think religious teachings and religious experiences try to point us towards.
Excellent. Other guys, something to jump in on at this point?
Casey, I have always just thought that verse was hilarious, like in a really fun way where Mormon's like, "Now, the others were happy too, but not quite to the point of passing out."
Right.
Yeah. But I do think your point about happiness is serving, it's among people, et cetera. I remember something in the Kahneman talk, the TED talk, Greg, that you linked us to. I think when he was talking about your experiential happiness versus your remembered happiness, there seemed like something in there he said was what seems to be the case that matters for both is if you are experiencing time with people you like. In other words, that's, yes, the experiential happiness, as well as when you're reflecting on that, you're still going to remember it that way. And so I don't know, there's something about this, just this idea of being in relationship and especially in affirming, genuine, mutual sharing kind of relationship. I think, that, I don't know, somehow it ties together for me.
One of my favorite ideas in Mormonism is the Ward family. I love that. I think it is something that we do really, really well. Like when it works, it works amazingly. And that's one thing that Grant Hardy said that I really liked, where he said, you know, "I don't know when I would deal with people like this. I don't know." And we hear these stories about, you know, you're assigned home teaching with people that you don't really have much in common with, or you people that you would not normally be friends with, and yet they end up being these amazing, rich relationships. And so I think especially potentially, and it's often actualized, Mormonism does relationships very, very well, with some very big and important exceptions.
Right. Yep. Good. Good.
Many of which Greg is living.
Greg, we'll let you jump in if you want. Otherwise, Casey, if you want to finish the Mormon framing, any more points that you had about,
sure,
you know, Mormon specific ideas on it. So,
yep. Let's see. So the next point is kind of related to the love of God as it relates to redemption and salvation, and this is maybe where, you know, plan of salvation and plan of happiness maybe become synonyms. And when Alma describes his conversion experience, you know, he says that as soon as he felt the redemption from his past, he said you know, what joy, what marvelous light. There was nothing so exquisite and sweet as was my joy. So this is kind of, you know, experiential happiness that we were talking about earlier. And then he sees, he kind of has this vision of seeing Father Lehi, seeing concourses of angels. And he says, and my soul did long to be there. I find that pretty interesting, because he's saying that nothing was so exquisite as his joy that he was currently experiencing. Yet at the same time, he was seeing something distant in the future and saying that his soul did long to be there. I don't know if that's a suggestion that he felt like he would have even greater happiness had he gone forward. But in any case, I think that kind of relates to kind of this future, you know, maybe afterlife, hope for something better in the future type of happiness that in some ways can keep people moving in a religious context.
Now, I know you had something to say about Zion and whatnot as a piece of this, or am I wrong? Why don't you go ahead and keep going? And
sure.
Maybe that's not next. Do it whenever it comes in.
That's my next point on here. So there's two points, at least in the Book of Mormon, where Mormon uses the superlative in describing happiness. One, he says, this is at the time when Nephites are preparing for battle against the Lamanites. He says, there never was a happier time among the people of Nephi, you know, than in the days of Moroni. Now, I think this one we may be able to take with a grain of salt, because Mormon seems to really have a thing for Moroni.
Man crush.
Right. It's certainly would seem like that. So if we discount that, the only other time that he says that there could not be a happier time is in 4th Nephi, when he's essentially describing a utopia, a Zion, where everyone's together, everyone, you know, is there's no contention. It, you know, it says there could not be a happier people among all the people who have been created by the hand of God. And I think that this idea of Zion, where we have unity and love and respect and continuous progression together, is kind of the golden standard, the Platonic ideal that not only religious communities, but I think any group of people or any network of relationships can move towards in the pursuit of happiness. And that certainly was a big theme in the Restoration. That certainly was one of the big purposes of having a temple and of gathering Israel and Zion and all these themes that we see, you know, in the both throughout the unfolding of the Restoration, but also in the current church. You know, we have stakes. Most people don't, especially, you know, new members, never quite get explained what does a stake mean. A stake of Zion, in that it's a tent, that we're all in this together. We might be in different geographic locations, but we're all working towards a common goal. And I would say, in my experiences, especially in my current calling, and this is where it kind of hits home for me, is I see that my role as ward mission leader, probably more than anything else, as Zion building, as community building, in terms of bringing people together and improving everyone's quality of life. Not only having people in the church help those coming into the church or out of the church improve their quality of life, but also the other way around, that by accepting influences, you know, of other people coming into the church, or by outreach to the community, I believe that those in the church are benefited through that. And so even though this idea of Zion is kind of abstract, I think if we use that kind of as a prime directive or a guiding principle for how we interact with others and how we define our relationships with others and how we choose what kind of actions we're going to take as we further, you know, our place in the community and our place among others, I think by following this Zion framework, we really will, at least in my experience, you know, I guess here's the testimony coming out. I really have seen that happiness and that peace and that satisfaction that comes from approaching Zion And I think that is worth working for, and that is worth fighting for. And I believe that inasmuch as that's the direction that we're heading, that is how we can experience increased happiness.
Cool. Thanks.
I like that a lot. I respond to Greg's kid point from way back, and it ties into Zion as well. I think one thing that we didn't talk about with their framing of happiness is kind of like a easy happiness versus hard happiness. I mean, we kind of talked about it a little bit, but it's like, what's the happiness of gaining a skill? What's the happiness? And I fit having children, you know, I have five, into that category where there are things that are extremely difficult and stressful and frustrating, perhaps in the moment. And yet there's this larger, there is a satisfaction, there is a happiness. So it happiness as an acquired taste, I think, might be a really good way to frame that. How getting into a habit of working out is really hard. Getting into a habit of eating extremely, extremely well is, it takes work, but that's what I think when I'm listening to your comments on Zion, Casey, is there are things, when you said there are things worth fighting for, there are things worth working for. I see that as that like acquired taste, difficult reward, you know, fruits of effort kind of happiness. And I think there's something really to that.
Sure. And let's see, did someone else want to comment on that?
No, I guess I want to say I can totally see that. And Jared, I am trying every day to have that kind of happiness with regard to my children, with regard to all of the things and all of the important things in life that I want to accomplish. I don't want to propose just a hedonistic view of like just pleasure. Although I do want to propose that pleasure is more important than the church gives it credence. But I think that all of that is great. I just don't think that it's exclusively Mormon. I just don't, you know, like,
I don't either.
I don't think any of us would say.
So if we say being a part of these larger things, I think it's possible to be happy in the church. One of my main points in that thread is it just didn't seem to be possible for me. But being a part of larger things, working hard to acquire skills, making of your life this masterpiece, if you will, I think that that's fabulous. But it's non-denominational. And so the question that I seem to run into is, so, okay, you know, there's a lot of nice things that you can do in the Mormon church. There's a lot of nice things that you can do elsewhere. Why do we as Mormons in a Mormon mindset, do we invalidate the idea that those causes and purposes that are outside of Mormonism have value?
I think we tend to say that it doesn't have as much value. Yes, so I think you're right there. I know that I could weigh in whenever somebody says that in the church and broaden it. But you're right. I think that's the rhetoric. That's the overarching unspokenness. What do you guys think?
I agree. I think one of the greatest improvements that could be made in the church, we've had conversations, Dan, about Mormonism as most true church, not only true church. And I think that's one of the most productive framings that can be formulated. I love what one source said. Mormonism is the most true, but not true enough church. But what I really, not yet true enough church. One thing that I would love to see in the church is admission that there are superior things outside the church. That not only is there, you know, I think most members would agree that Mormonism does not have all the truth, you know, all the truth, all the goodness, because that's intuitive. But I think where you'd get some pushback is the idea that there is goodness and truth in other traditions that we don't have. Or at least if that's there, I don't see it emphasized. I would love to see missionaries saying, we have a message of happiness for you, and we want to learn from you as well.
Right.
What do you think, Casey?
Yeah, I think, like I said, my experience, at least through my childhood, growing up in a place where I was a religious minority, I certainly appreciated and got a sense that there was much goodness and beauty and truth and things to validate in other people's, you know, cultures and life experiences and things like that. You know, as it relates to the LDS Church and is the question of, have we achieved Zion? I think there's some very important insight, and again, this is going to come from the scriptures, from Doctrine and Covenants. You know, if we were to ask God what he thinks about Zion, this was his reply. He says, "Now I, the Lord," this is in DNC 68:31. "Now I, the Lord, am not well pleased with the inhabitants of Zion, for there are idlers among them, and their children are also growing up in wickedness. And they also seek not earnestly for the riches of eternity, but their eyes are full of greediness. These things ought not to be, but must be done away from among them." So this is directed at no one but the LDS Church.
Well, I think we definitely get the rhetoric of, like, we fall short in the church. There's no shortage of that at all. But I'm thinking of quotes that I really cherish. Article of Faith 13, it was really sweet when my daughter turned 12 last week. We were talking about what Article of Faith she was going to say in church, and I talked about how much I loved 13, and she's like, well, I want to do that one. And so she took the extra effort to memorize it and share that one. But I'm thinking of the quotes of Joseph Smith Brigham Young that are like, if there is any good in Methodism, if there's any good in any other religion, it is part of Mormonism. We claim it. We embrace it. And I love that. I just don't see it in day-to-day discourse in Mormonism.
Right.
Yeah. I think there's definitely something to that. And, you know, maybe that's the next step in approaching Zion.
Cool.
I'd hope so.
Let's move into another section. I don't know that we need to take more than 5 minutes, but we all kind of agreed ahead of time that the idea of temperament is such a big part of happiness, that we just this awareness that some people fundamentally feel the world differently than other people do. Some feel it as hostile, some feel it as affirming. Sometimes, of course, that's tied to early childhood, first experiences, you know, all that kind of stuff and things too. But just in general, you get to this area that say there's no right way or wrong way when it comes to this, but some people are naturally more comfortable with a world that is lined up for them and says, here is the pattern, here is the path, here are the answers, and they naturally seek to feel life in terms of order. Where there's other people that are perhaps more of a, I don't need it to all make sense, I kind of only need to have a feel for it. I don't know, I feel the gist of the universe rather than wanting to be able to say it with my head and out my mouth kind of feel. So we have these different temperaments. Does anybody want to broadly frame what, when they hear the word temperament, before we go into a very Mormon-specific and important framing that was given about this?
Yeah, I don't think that we can overemphasize this. I don't think we can emphasize it enough, Dan. I'm so glad we're talking about it. And this is one area of strength as far as, like, you know, postmodernism goes, is the appreciation for situatedness, the appreciation for individual needs, individual chemistry. And I think this is an important way to set up our discussion about the relationship to the church, because each person's experience with the church is different. And so there is no one-size-fits-all solution, because people respond differently. Because as you said, we do have different temperaments. It's interesting because early on in grad school, I used to think that anyone smart enough to get themselves into trouble, as far as faith goes, should be smart enough to get themselves out of it. And that had to do with a fundamental misunderstanding on my part that history is a very, very different endeavor than theology, for example. And one thing that I see, and Greg and I have had productive, I hope, discussions about this, is whether you are a black and white all or nothing thinker, or whether you are, you know, nuanced, and I'm not making any value judgments whatsoever about this, but I mean, it can be trained, it can be, you know, Dan, you and I have both gone through that whole process of, you know, grad school where you're really trained to nuance and complicate and all that. But I've always, my mom would say I overcomplicated things all the time, mm-hmm, even when I was a teenager. And my response was, Mom, I think that reality is fundamentally so complicated, more complicated than anything we can understand. Therefore, my mistake could not be overcomplicating it, but just complicating it in a way that does not correspond with reality. So I think I proved my point just by the way I responded. But I think it's very important to acknowledge the way that we interact differently with reality, with the church, with each other, and so forth.
Cool. Let's just go ahead and dive in and offer the framing. I'm guessing that a lot of our listeners will have heard this before, but there was an amazing, or at least a very influential talk in Mormon intellectual circles that I should have looked it up, but I'm guessing it's late 60s, early 70s is when a BYU history professor named Richard Poll, P-O-L-L, gave a talk at his Palo Alto home ward, and it was called What the Church Means to People Like Me. And I'll go ahead and post a link on the website to that. But it was such an influential talk because he said, when I mean people like me, I'm going to divide us into two camps. And he says, of course, these aren't clean examples or something like this, but he says there's two great metaphors, both within the Book of Mormon, that he feels sort of speaks to different temperaments within the church. And he says, one isn't right, the other one isn't wrong, they're just different. And I know that, Greg, you said it helped you to hear his framing at one time. I know it did for me. When I first encountered this, I go, thank you, thank you, thank you. Now I have a positive image for when I'm feeling squeezed out of the church. And so his two things are, he says there's the iron rod as a metaphor within the Mormonism, and then there's the Liahona. The iron rod in Tree of Life, the vision that Casey already talked about a little bit, is, of course, the idea of if you hold to the rod and you never let go of the rod, whatever the mists of darkness and the forces or the people taunting you from the great and spacious building, if you hold on to that rod, it will lead you steadily to the tree of life, that love of God, that experience. And he says that's a wonderful metaphor within Mormonism. But he says we also have this interesting thing, this Liahona, which is a compass. It's simply a pointer that says, go that direction. And it's not necessarily every step of the way you'll be grabbing on to this particular thing, but if you're in tune, it will always point you and orient you towards your goal. And so he says that he believes that people, in general, have these two temperaments. There's more temperaments, certainly. I don't know if you know the origins of all this, you guys, is in the Greeks and the idea of humors, you know, H-U-M-O-U-Rs within the body. If you're phlegmatic or if you're sanguine, you know, or if you're bilious, you know, all these different fluids within your body. So the early Greeks recognized four different temperaments, and we've got, you know, what is it, all the, your color codes and your, what's the one that, you know, I'm a J-E, I can't remember what those different,
like ININP.
Yeah. All those different things are all playing in this thing. So but the idea is that some Latter-day Saints are more naturally oriented towards, tell me the rules, tell me how to get there, eyes always forward, always on the rod, focused on answers. Tell me the answers. Whereas he says people like him, he was using himself as an example of a Liahona, are, I'm more interested in the question. I'm more interested in the theory. Yeah, show me the right direction. Show me where I'm heading, but I'm comfortable, you know, getting there on my own without needing to be commanded in all things or something like that. So, again, I don't want to have any value judgments in there, but what else, from any of you who've read this thing, is there pieces of this iron rod Liahona thing that I've left out that should be said?
I think that's entered into, I mean, like the whole I'm an iron rodder versus Liahona, I think that's entered into normal Mormon discourse. I have a funny story. I was bearing my testimony once, similar to the temperament thing, and I said in my testimony that I don't think Mormonism is for everyone in this life. And it really disturbed one of our friends, and she went to Katrina, and she's like, what did Jared mean by that? So it's interesting. Casey, I want to ask you if you think I'm looking too much into this. It's a fun little scriptural tidbit about the iron rod.
Sure.
It's interesting how in 8:24, the ones clinging to the iron rod fall away. But the ones in later in the verse, pressing forward, holding fast, remain. And so I think, do you think I'm reading too much into it by saying that if we hold too tightly to the rules, that it can backfire?
I'm not sure. I hadn't noticed that until now.
Yeah, me either. Wow.
That's it's a fun tidbit.
Can you give that reference again, Jared?
Yep. Chapter 8, verse 24, it said, they go through the mist of darkness.
First Nephi 8:24.
They go clinging to the rod of iron. They get to the fruit, and then they're the ones who act ashamed once they get the fruit, and then they fall away. But in the end, it said, in 30, there are those who caught the hold of Ryan. They had pressed rod of iron. They had pressed their way forward, continually holding fast to the rod of iron until they came forth and fell down, which interesting is the same language of them falling down before Christ.
Yeah.
In particular, the fruit of the tree. I have to say, I really do love the Book of Mormon. I think that there's so much richness to it and so many of these little tiny details that I think are in there.
I really like that, Jared. I don't have much to comment on it because I guess I'm still processing it. But
That would be my response to maybe nuancing it a bit, Dan, because I think that especially those of us who are Liahona types, it's really easy to look down on the iron rod approach. And I just like that as maybe a defense of the iron rod, is that even within the tradition itself that talks about the iron rod, it says there is a way to approach the laws. There's a way to approach the rules that is more balanced. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it's been something that has been meaningful for me in the past.
Cool. But of course, it's easy for iron rods to find things to critique about Liahonas too.
We're apostate, right?
From there, yeah. Well, or just like, oh, when will you learn that wickedness ever was happiness? Or you're eventually going to have to enter through the straight gate. So what are you guys doing out there? You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I really loved that talk when I read it. It was an interesting moment because it was definitely the moment when I was out. I was done. And I read it and I wrote my wife an email and I was like, this talk is fantastic. But I also recognized, because really my disposition, to my chagrin, is the black and white disposition. Like I talk about trying to pixelate that, break down the black and white into as small pieces as possible so I can deal with it, because I just don't know how to do it any other way. But even when I read it, I said, and of course, this Richard Pohl is, to the institutional church, an apostate. And Harold B. Lee, you know, went through and happily validated that, you know, a few years later.
By calling Richard Pohl an apostate?
By referencing the Iron Rod Liahona talk in general conference subtly and saying that liberal Mormons were, yeah, that there's no such thing as a liberal Mormon. Have you not ever read that, Dan?
I didn't know that he deliberately attacked that, I guess.
I think I even read Richard Pohl talking about, sort of referencing back to that. We could look at that, and I don't know if that's really important for this. But when I read that, my wife was very happy because she's very much more in her nature. She's very much more of Liahona type, and I'm much more of an iron rod type. And I said to her, you know, a couple of things here. One, this talk is apostate, even if he's being nice, and I like it a lot because it does not go in line with what the brethren teach. It doesn't go in line with the institutional church. I could be wrong there. I'm not concerned about that now. And I also said, and he's really just saying, I don't really believe this stuff, but I like it a lot. And I said, you know, and so, it, you know, it does a lot of things for my life, but I don't believe that it's literally true. And I just have never been able to care very much. If it's not literally true, then I know that this is where I part ways with some of you. If it's not literally true, then I have other better things to do with my life. And that's really kind of, even at that moment, it was in one day. I read it. I loved it. But I also, you know, just this isn't going to keep me in or something.
It sounds like that's a good segue maybe to talk about our approach.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.